Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
The first topic we're going to cover today is the case of the gestating brain-dead mother. Have you heard of this?
I have not. Sounds interesting, though.
So recently, a Georgia woman who was 2 months pregnant suffered blood clots to the brain and was later declared dead by neurological criteria, i.e. Mm-hmm. brain dead. So under the law, her body is now a cadaver.
Mm-hmm.
Her family says that Emory Hospital doctors have told them they're not allowed to stop or remove devices that are keeping her breathing because state law bans abortion after cardiac activity can be detected in the fetus, which is normally around 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. She's 2 months pregnant. So Georgia's abortion ban includes an exception if the abortion is necessary to maintain the woman's life. We'll set that aside for Catholic teaching purposes.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So we have abortion is outlawed in Georgia after fetal heartbeat is detected with a health of mother exception. But this doesn't apply here. The baby's considered a natural person under the law.
Mm-hmm.
But
because they are, yes.
But removing medical technology would not be an abortion here because nothing would be administered to end the pregnancy, nor would the pregnancy be terminated surgically. If the mother's body ceased functioning, the baby would die naturally. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the hospital is not legally required to maintain this woman's body.
Sure.
So what are your thoughts?
Well, it's a very interesting case, and I think it brings out some excellent principles of Catholic, moral ethics and ethical teaching. When there's obviously that baby is a human being, and we're setting aside the legality of what's allowed or permitted or forbidden under Georgia law, from an ethical standpoint, that baby is a human being. They're alive. And so they deserve the medical treatment and the care that we can give them to survive. Now, the mother, if she is brain dead, she's not going to recover, but her body is still functioning. She's being artificially kept alive. That is providing a place for that baby to grow and to come to term. So under those circumstances, I think it'd be fully legitimate and encouraged for the parents to keep the woman's body functioning, breathing, keeping on the apparatus.
It's the grandparents, right? Because the the mom is incapacitated.
Okay. There's no father in the picture?
They didn't mention his status.
Okay. Right. So I would think in that case that the grandparents who are there caring for their grandchild would want to provide every medical opportunity for that child to come to term and then be born.
I think they're the ones wanting to pull the plug, though, the grandparents.
Mm.
So what I find interesting here is there's been arguments on both sides of this news story. Some of the same folks which in Georgia law allows that bodies of people that are declared brain dead to be maintained for organ donation. Some of the mm-hmm. same folks who would advocate to keep the body alive for organ donation might be the same folks who are saying, pull the plug because there's a baby in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy the culture of death that we default to.
Right. That is fascinating. And so many things, and you get these extreme cases, they reveal what's in the heart of people. I think you could make an ethical case for allowing the natural death of the baby to occur as the mother, because the mother is not going to recover. And I'm no doctor, of course, but that from an ethical standpoint, there's no reason for the keeping alive a person artificially beyond ordinary means. What the church means by ordinary means is food and air, be able to breathe and to drink water and to feed. If a person can't feed themselves, the church teaches you don't have to put in a feeding tube. You don't have to put them on a respirator. You can allow them to die. That's perfectly fine. In this case, if the mother were allowed to die and follow the natural course, the baby would die as well. But because there is another life there, I think generally the tendency would be towards, let's try to save the life of that baby if it can come to term and then come into this world.
You would hope so, especially if you're on the same side of the keeping the mother alive for organ donation.
And valuing life. You know, life is a beautiful gift. And we do believe, and we know from science, that is a human being. Not viable yet, because they're not yet outside of the womb. But science has advanced that you could get preemies who are just, you know, I don't know what the youngest age now is that they've been able to save a preemie, but it's something, you know, really incredibly small.
Right. Every year it grows earlier in the pregnancy term, the gestation term. So a funny aside on this was somebody mentioned a Dallas, Texas woman who keeps getting tickets for driving in the HOV lane when she's pregnant. So,
Chris, the first time, that is kind of funny.
Well, the first time she got the ticket, the judge, she argued, I've got a baby in here, so I've got two people in the car. The judge threw it out, and she keeps getting tickets. And so they're actually, there's somebody sponsoring a bill in Texas now trying to codify that
pregnant
women are allowed in the HOV lane.
I love that. That's great.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires. Let's talk about charter schools and religious neutrality.
Great. That sounds like a fun topic.
All right. So charter schools are publicly funded but independently operated schools.
Mm-hmm.
Recent Supreme Court decisions have expanded the rights of religious groups in education. There's been a couple of cases where the court has ruled states cannot exclude religious schools from programs that provide public funding to private schools. If a state provides tuition assistance to private schools, it must include religious schools as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a potential turning point here in Oklahoma. The Oklahoma State Charter Board approved the first taxpayer-funded religious charter school, St. Isidore of Seville. It plans to include Catholic doctrine in its curriculum. What are the implications for Muslim, Jewish, and other non-Christian families? By that, I mean Muslim, Jews, and non-Christians would essentially be contributing to funding religious education that they don't necessarily believe in.
Mm-hmm. Great points. A lot of issues that come into play with this one, Chris. And I think we have to go back to the original intent of why we have schools and why the government funds anything. Sometimes we need to come to a common ground on these elements, because if you get caught up too much in side arguments, you lose the sight of the big picture. The government has a vested interest in its people being well-educated. And unfortunately, the public education system is really falling down on the job in many sectors, not because of lack of dedication of people, but sometimes because of the very ideology that's behind it. You look at the origins of the education system in the United States, and there's a lot of relativism, which is built into some of the early academic theory, which has guided the American public education system. And we all know the documented effects of when it used to be prayer in public schools. That was part of the curriculum up until the 1940s. And there was a Supreme Court case in which some atheist families brought it up all the way up to the Supreme Court and got prayer kicked out of public schools. And the demise of public schools since the exclusion of God is just a well-documented reality. So the public school system in many respects has been failing because it's lost the reference to God. And that has become a disservice to our very country. Because a well-educated populace is the foundation for a healthy running democracy. When you don't have good education, or when education gets ramrodded into a relativistic worldview, what you have then is the dominance of what happens in every ideologically driven society. It's no longer the prevalence of truth, it's the prevalence of power. And that's what's happened in so many fascist countries in history and in places like the Soviet Union, where it just becomes the state imposing its views of the age. Okay, so let's keep it in that bigger perspective. So the state has a vested interest in
procuring the common good.
Yes.
And religious schools have shown to be better performing all over the country, no matter the state.
And cost less and better outcomes.
and that's for the common good.
Right.
But then you have the Establishment Clause in the U.S. Constitution regarding separation of church and state. And so...
Yes, but that's also in how you interpret it. Okay, that was actually a posterior introduction that is not in the Constitution of the United States.
Right.
It's an introduction, that something that was introduced later by Thomas Jefferson. So it's a clause that came in much later, and it depends on how you interpret that. You can interpret it in a very negative way, like the exclusion of religion from public discourse, or you can interpret it as let's keep a proper distance, like what it says in the gospel. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's.
I agree that we've warped the interpretation of the Establishment Clause, but let's say you lived in a predominantly Muslim area and you are Christian and you're now
Happening in our backyard recently.
But your tax dollars are then being forced to Muslim education.
There's a Muslim school that just started around the corner. I was talking with a couple of other priests about that the other day. And, where Muslim schools have come into place, what's happening? They're transmitting an ideology, a worldview of Islam in which there's the unity of church and state. It does become a problem. And I think this is where we need to have public dialogue and discourse about what does contribute to the good of the state and what doesn't. Yeah. And in a Catholic worldview, there is this separation of a healthy separation of church and state. There's a recognition of the power of truth beyond any political fads or any other fads that can come and go. So a Catholic worldview does contribute to the Constitution and the lasting of a healthy state.
I think what you're getting at is that maybe some of these ideologically based Muslim schools aren't contributing to the common good. And that
clearly
might be the reason why.
Yes. Or look at Satanism.
That's what I was just about to bring up. What if you had an area of Wiccans that wanted to start a witch school?
That's been an argument in a lot of different states that have wrestled with this. Freedom of religion, right? So we can have Wiccans and we can have Satanists. Well, does that worldview actually contribute to a healthy society? Clearly not. Okay, because it's promoting vice and not a reference to truth and simply power. So we have to examine at the deeper level, does this particular worldview contribute to a democratic society? Does it contribute to a healthy society? Catholic worldview does, and that's been proved over the centuries. Christianity does. That's why we've had such a strong and robust country. Other worldviews don't, and we need to have that public discourse and not have simplistic approach to say, well, all religions are equal. No, they're not. Some are better than others, objectively, and some contribute to the thriving of a society and thriving of the human person, and others don't.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires. Okay, let's talk about birds.
I love birds. You know one of my favorite board games? It's called Wingspan. Really fun game where you actually have to pick different birds.
I figured you were a shoots and ladders guy.
No, definitely not shoots and ladders. But anyway, let's talk about birds.
All right. So members of certain types of bird groups like crows, ravens, and parrots show remarkable cognitive abilities. They demonstrate tool use, problem solving, vocal learning, and episodic-like memory. However, bird brains are structured differently than mammal brains. They lack a neocortex. So birds have instead what's called a nested pallium, which supports similar cognitive functions to what mammals have. So mammal intelligence is characterized by abstract reasoning, planning, complex social cognition, use of tools, languages, etc. So these capabilities are largely associated with the neocortex, which is unique to mammals. So recently, they've come to this conclusion that bird and mammal intelligence has evolved separately through what's called convergent evolution. So despite the differences in brain structure, both groups arrived at similar cognitive capabilities, illustrating how evolution can find multiple solutions to the same challenges. So where I found this interesting is in the context of Catholic teaching is I often get asked by non-Catholics, particularly people in my family, about what happens when we encounter some form of intelligent life on another planet. How does that how are you going to reconcile that with Catholic teaching and man made in the image and likeness of God? Mm-hmm. So I found this story fascinating because I think this is the answer. Let's say birds didn't exist on planet Earth,
mm-hmm.
and we go and explore planet X, and we find this species, and we call them birds, and we find that they do these things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Would we be troubled?
Not at all.
Right?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating, the diversity of God's creation. I think that whenever we find a new species or learn new things about animal life or like geology or other planets, I find it so fascinating. And I think that's why down through history, some of the greatest scientists and discoverers have been Catholics who, driven by their faith, are trying to understand better the beauty of what God has created, what he's given to us. And there have been shifting theories all through the years. We know that, for example, the Big Bang Theory was invented by a Catholic priest.
Right.
The gene theory was a Catholic monk. So many discoveries have been tied back to our faith. We're not afraid of discovering the truth, discovering new things that will shift the way that we've understood things until now. And I think that that's one of the beautiful things about our Catholic faith, because we're seeking the truth. We're not seeking to defend something. And sometimes even I get a little irked when I hear, Chris, that, we got to defend the faith. We don't need to defend the faith. God's big enough to take care of himself. You know, we don't have to defend the faith. We just need to speak the truth. The truth has a power of its own. So in this whole area of bird intelligence, for example, there's developing theories and understanding, and especially when you start going into the realm of artificial intelligence. You know, this is the whole new frontier, and Pope Leo has been talking about this, and that the church is trying to give some indicators and guidance to help us to take this new frontier of science in a way that will actually enhance the dignity of the human person, put the human person at the center, and not be used by it. And this is a critical distinction. Do we use technology, or are we used by it? And so whether we're talking about bird brains, yeah. or
again, where I found this interesting was someday we'll, probably find maybe it's a bacteria-like life form on another planet, mm-hmm. or it could be some, intelligent species.
Possibly.
It's not any threat to our Catholic teachings, because only man is made in the image and likeness of God.
Right.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires.
Next thing I want to discuss is the low birth rate in the U.S. and around the world,
sure.
particularly in the U.S. So the average U.S. woman will give birth to 1.6 children over her lifetime. That's far below the replacement rate mm-hmm. of 2.1. There have been a series of op-ed pieces and some symposium talks lately about how to address this. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal by a Syracuse professor entitled "How to Make American Babies Again."
Hmm.
He encourages the use of IVF, in vitro fertilization, and more specifically, making IVF more affordable. There was a separate piece in the National Review advocating for expanded child tax credits and $5,000 baby bonuses to help with the upfront costs. Mm-hmm. of children. Then recently, former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was discussing the birth rate issue at an appearance in New York, and she lamented that some of the Heritage Foundation suggestions, which they're trying to emphasize the return to the focus on the nuclear family, return to being a Christian nation, and return to producing a lot of children, are antithetical to the progress of the modern feminist movement.
Hmm.
So a low birth rate is concerning, but is not in and of itself immoral. And there's there's really not a debate here about what the Catholic Church teaches about, the use of IVF. But I think what I found interesting is this back and forth that's going on. The Heritage Foundation seems to get it right on how we ought to be focusing on this return to the focus on the nuclear family. Yet everybody else wants to come to it from a different way, mm-hmm. money or using artificial means.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the countries that have attempted that, because there are low birth rates, and you know, Japan has historically for the last 20 years very low birth rate. You got entire towns that are now depopulated in Japan. There's a priest in my community who's from South Korea. South Korea now has the lowest birth rate in the entire world. And after the civil war there, they had a huge, you know, very high birth rate. And it's just it's a cultural shift. So what people aren't grasping is the reason why people aren't having children isn't just because of access to contraception or other factors. It's because they don't want to have children. I can't tell you the number of conversations I've had with women or men who say, well, I don't want to bring a child into this world. And it's younger people who have everything together. They've got money. They've got a good job. You know, Father Abraham, who was in my community from South Korea, he's got, two siblings. Neither one of them has any children, and they have no intention of having children. They've got good, high-paying jobs, and their whole mentality is an anti-life mentality.
Or even if you don't have the anti-life, you have this situation which exists now in affluent America, where everybody wants to wait until they have enough money. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, after 30, your fertility rates start to decline. They even if you want, you may not get.
That's exactly right. And so many couples that I know have struggled with fertility. Everyone thinks, oh, you're going to get pregnant. You're going to be like, reproduce like rabbits. No, it's not that simple. And oftentimes couples do have difficulty. And that's why IVF has grown in prominence in our country, which is a whole industry. And I think we have to be careful with this, because people don't realize that it's, $50,000 a crack to try to get a baby, to produce a baby. And therein lies a lot of the problem with the whole IVF industry. You know, some people will posit it as a very pro-life type of industry, but it's actually a money-making industry. And there are other ways of dealing with fertility issues that are much more cost-effective and more effective overall. The Paul VI Institute has helped tons of couples to work through their fertility problems and have a baby in the natural way. But there are a number of issues with IVF as a procedure. There is one form of IVF which is morally illicit, but without getting into all the particulars, it's a very, very narrow set of what's done. So the majority of what's done in the IVF field is actually morally illicit on various grounds, primarily because you're producing a child rather than receiving a child as a gift, and some of the ways that goes about.
Yeah, and so the way it's being bantied about is, like, particularly in that one editorial that I read, it was almost like the lesser of two evils was to just go ahead and rely on IVF, and regardless of any of the ethical issues surrounding it, it's better than having a birth rate below replacement. And my answer to that is no, it's not, because it's not a birth rate below replacement is not morally wrong. It's not what we want.
There are actually natural cycles in history and in the lifespan of a country. You start taking more of the long-term vision of this, you realize that when a country goes into a phase of higher development, higher education, the birth rate goes down. Birth rates are always higher in countries where there's war, where there's famine, where there is significant trauma going on, and where the education rate is lower. So that's why sub-Saharan Africa has much higher birth rates right now than the rest of the world, whereas Europe, Japan, much of Asia, developed Asia, the United States and North America, very low birth rates because we have a higher education attainment level. And that's not morally wrong. You're right.
Right. But let's say, though, economically it's wrong. It's going to be...
Well, it creates cycles in history.
It creates a problem, economically for us to be in a non-replacement scenario.
And largely because of a welfare mentality and the welfare state. When you're giving out more and more, it's based on having a large workforce, which is producing and putting money into that pot. So the way that we've designed the system is problematic economically. Yes.
Well, I'll let you have the last word on this, though. The question that comes to my mind, though, is there a Catholic position officially that we should be reproducing? I mean, that's what the Bible tells us, be fruitful and multiply. Is it, even though it's not morally illicit to have a replacement, a below replacement rate birth ratio, is there a Catholic stance that is actively advocating the opposite?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can go back and read Humanae Vitae, which is a beautiful encyclical from Pope Paul VI, talking about the understanding of human life and the value of human life. That's one aspect. What I've found personally working with couples and working with families is that there's a spiritual dimension to all of this, where there's an openness to life. There is something qualitatively that's different. Like, their people's relationship with God and with each other as spouses is deeper and more beautiful. So taking it strictly from a more of that personal standpoint, there's a richness and a beauty that I see in couples that have that openness to life. And openness to life doesn't mean they're necessarily going to have more and more children, or be like, reproducing like rabbits, which is the insult that's sometimes thrown at them. They have a better quality of life. They have a better relationship. And the beauty of sometimes a larger family is well worth the sacrifices.
Well, because children are a gift, not a product.
They are exactly right, Chris.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crosswires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens. On AM 1160, The Quest.